Greetings, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for tuning in to the Vigilance Press Podcast. I'm your host today, James Dossie, and tonight I have a very special guest with me. I have Steve Kenson. Steve, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing very well, thanks.
Now, Steve is actually the original designer for the Mutants and Masterminds role-playing game, and he's worked on most of the role-playing games that have ever been done with superheroes, right?
Yeah, quite a few. Quite a few.
Yeah, we were talking about that on the forums the other day. I think the only one that you'd missed, wasn't it? You said you had. I remember this from a previous podcast. Mm-hmm. You had not had a chance to work on the DC Heroes game.
Yeah, the original DC Heroes game was before I was really involved in the industry, so I did not have an opportunity to work on that.
Okay, but you did work on the Marvel Heroes game or the Marvel Superheroes game.
I did. I worked on the Marvel Superheroes Adventure game, but not the original Marvel Superheroes
RPG. Oh, not the one from TSR. Okay.
No, that one also predates my time in the industry. So.
Okay, cool. Well, you've basically just flown cross-country. We were talking about that before the show. Yep. And it's glad to hear you had a safe flight home. Mm-hmm. So what's the weather like up where you are right now?
It's finally hit what we would call fall. Around New England, so it's gotten a nice chill in the air, and it's gotten really kind of crisp and clear autumn weather. So that's really nice. We had a stretch there where it was a lot more like August than October.
Yeah, I know the feeling. We've got this time of year is when we get a lot of kind of thunderstorms rolling through. But it's finally starting to taper off and get cool again. So I look forward to the 1 or 2 months of fall before the insanity that is winter here in Atlanta.
Yes, indeed.
But anyway, you just came back from the big Green Ronin meeting that you guys have this once every year, right?
Yeah. Pretty much every October, we have a company-wide meeting in Seattle to get everybody together in one room, basically, and to sit down and go over, you know, everything, you know, from the previous year and how things have done, and basically plan out our schedule for the coming year, and you know, brainstorm and talk about our plans and work out things, and then we, you know, work out a master schedule and realize that we can't do that, and that we have to move things around and, you know, finagle the schedule to make it all work. So it's 3 days of a lot of work and a lot of discussion, but it's also a lot of fun because it's one of the few times that we're all, you know, hanging out together in the same space. So,
yeah, and having met most of you, or at least in passing, I can imagine that it's got more of a party atmosphere than your usual summit.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not exactly what you would call formal.
Well, that's good. So, did you guys have any new projects or announcements that you're able to talk about yet, or is that still something that you're a ways out from?
Well, we've got the initial stuff that's coming up. Basically, as we move in towards the end of the year, we're wrapping up the threat report PDF series that we've been doing, which for folks who aren't familiar with it is basically a weekly series that features a short 4 or 5 page profile, usually on a single villain, sometimes on a small team of villains. That initially started out as basically we're going to do a villain a week kind of product when Mutants and Masterminds 3rd Edition launched. Mm-hmm. And we've basically been doing that product for about a year now, and we wanted to phase it out in order to do something different. Just because we've been doing it for quite a while, and although response to it has been very positive, we want to, you know, just not drag things out forever as far as that goes.
Yeah, a lot of people have been asking about when a print collection of that might be coming together and how big the collections might be. Any word on that yet?
It's a good chance that folks may see a print collection sometime next year.
Hmm.
And part of the reason why we're wrapping up the threat report series this year is so that we can start up a new weekly PDF series in the coming year. The new series is called Power Profiles. And basically, instead of doing a particular villain character each week with the villain's stats and adventure hooks and whatnot, we're going to take a look at a particular type of superpower each week. One power profile may, for example, look at weather control powers, where another power profile may examine super speed or fire control or, you know, any of those aquatic powers.
Right, right.
You know, et cetera.
So, and basically, so instead of like a character format structure, you're actually they're going to be like essays, or how are they put together?
Basically, the power profiles break down into several parts. One is just a brief sort of overview about the high concept of the power. What is this type of power about? You know, what are the type of characters that tend to have it? The main bulk of each issue is basically a collection of worked powers. So we take, you know, that particular type of power, and then we break down all of its various permutations and say, okay, weather control, what can you do with it? You know, well, if you can create high winds, and you can create fog, and you can create rain, and you can create storms and lightning and et cetera. How do you build all of those things? And we provide you with worked out examples of all those effects in game terms. And then the power profile basically just becomes kind of a simple pick and choose menu. You say, okay, well, I want to play a guy who's got weather powers. Well, you flip, you know, through the weather control power profile and say, well, I want him to have this one and this one and this one and this one, and not so crazy about this one. And maybe I'll put all of these together into an array, and I'll keep this thing separate. And we'll give you some advice in there about those kind of arrangements as well.
Mm-hmm.
And then basically we follow it up with a sort of closing section that looks at complications that relate to that power set. You know, what are some of the common, you know, complications the characters with those powers might face that you can also build into your character concept and say, okay, well, here are some ready-made ideas. My weather control character, a common complication or problem for weather controllers is that the weather sometimes reflects their mood. And that can
Very
be a
cool.
potential complication for them. And mm-hmm. here's how you play that out in game terms. And here's when the game master gives you a hero point for it. Certain power profiles will probably also have short little sidebars or essays dealing with things that are very specific to that power set, whether it be a particular tricky game mechanic or a particular interpretation of the power's descriptors or effects. So, for example, like the fire powers power profile will probably need to some degree to talk about like what happens if things catch fire, and you know, to what degree do you need to deal with that in the game, and what happens when a character is throwing around fire control in a building full of flammable things, and those sorts of issues will probably tend to come up.
Ah, interesting. So these are and you're planning to do one of these once a week.
That's the plan.
So that's it's essentially sounds like a very kind of exploded version of the Ultimate Powers book from second edition, where instead of having just a powers chapter, you're actually blowing up each individual power into its own essay.
Essentially, yeah. It's going to be unlike Ultimate Power. It's going to be a lot more in the form of worked examples mm-hmm. of the power effects and modifiers in the core rules. And although there, I won't say that there absolutely won't be any new effects or modifiers in power profiles. That'll be kept to an absolute minimum.
Mm-hmm.
And we want to, as much as possible, show how to use the existing tools in the game to create and execute things rather than layer on a lot of additional options as far as that goes.
Right. So this isn't a matter of rebalancing or reevaluating. This is more a matter of just kind of educating people on how they can use the existing rules.
Yes, it's much more of a how-to set of worked examples than it is a you need to change the way this works kind of approach. We probably, again, will address some options in terms of effects or modifiers that people may find problematic in some way. But that'll probably be more in the form of optional sidebars and things like that.
Very cool. Okay. Wow. So that's going to be a fun, that's going to be a fun series. I'm looking forward to that. I was really, as a game master, I was kind of always looking to see what the newest edition of the weekly updates to the threat reports were going to be, because I was always wondering. I love the Looking Glass gang. I thought
they were a lot of fun.
Yeah. But there's just, always something new to look forward to. So this is really cool. Do you know what the first couple are going to be and what about what, do you plan to launch them in January the way you did, this past series of threat reports?
The plan is to have threat report wrapped up by the end of this year and to, launch power profiles, in the beginning of 2012.
Okay. Very cool. Very cool. All right. Was there anything else from, the summit that, you wanted to bring up or...
That's pretty much the big thing that's coming up. We've got some other plans in the works. We're definitely going to continue making use of the smaller electronic releases as a way of providing really regular content for the game line, and the print releases are still, coming, and there definitely still will be print releases, but they're probably going to be spaced out a bit comparatively.
Okay. So you're basically shifting gears a little bit, becoming a little bit more of a digital publisher for the regular content, and then shifting to, the bigger releases, just kind of spacing those out a bit more.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That's interesting. Speaking of the print releases, I know that they've been. John gave me the update on the Heroes and Villains Volume 2 for DC. That it's been sent off to DC for evaluation. But
right.
I forgot to ask him where you guys were at with the Emerald City source book. Where are we with that? Do you know?
Emerald City is wrapping up in development and is planned for a release next year.
Very cool. Okay. Yeah, so. That's a book that I'm very much looking forward to. I've always loved
me too.
I can imagine. But I was wondering about how much of that was yours this time around, because I know Freedom City has usually been primarily your baby.
Mm-hmm. Well, Emerald City was definitely a team effort.
Mm-hmm.
I did some of the initial concept work when we were planning out the third edition release, and so I did the initial really kind of embarrassing sketch map of the region, because I'm a terrible cartographer, and all the map. Our actual cartographer would, look at the map and be like, you realize that, this thing is not at all the scale, right? I'm like, yeah, I know. this thing wouldn't be anywhere near this. And yeah, I'm like, well, yeah, sure. You get the idea, though. There's a mountain there.
I'm sorry. I haven't had time to paint it or make
right,
it the scale,
right,
the old Dr. Brown line from Back to the Future.
So I did some of the concept designing of I worked out the general overall layout of the area, what a lot of its character was, what its major divisions and neighborhoods and districts were, and sort of the big essential geographic stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Worked out some of the historical elements. John and I worked together on a lot of the characters. John did the bulk of the concept work on the Sentinels, the signature heroes, as well as a lot of the villain characters. And we, John and I went back and forth brainstorming a lot of things that we wanted to include, and then, you know, put together a pretty substantial outline that freelance writers like Christopher McLaughlin, who's done a number of products for Green Ronin, then ably took and fleshed out in greater detail, adding their own particular details to different parts of the city, giving it some additional character. And I think the overall result creates a pretty interesting setting that has a lot of what is a lot of the sense of history and wonder to it that that made makes Freedom City a really cool setting, but also that that makes Emerald City unique and distinctive and very much its own sort of entity.
Cool, very cool. Yeah, that that was one of the books. I mean, I'm very much looking forward to Heroes and Villains Volume 2, but you know, I think you know, again, being a playtester has kind of put me in the space of, you know, if I've already seen it, I'm much more interested in stuff I haven't seen yet.
Yeah.
I haven't had a chance to see Emerald City yet. Yeah. But, yeah, I'm very excited about that. But very cool. Well, you actually just released a book, and we can jump into that with the GM's Guidebook. And before we spend our whole time talking about stuff that hasn't come out yet, I want to let you have a chance to talk to us a little bit about the guidebook. The GM's Guidebook, was it about 2 weeks ago now came out?
That sounds about right.
Yeah. And It's would you consider that basically the second rule book for Mutants and Masterminds?
Yes and no.
Okay.
I mean, you know, it is very much a rule book. I don't know if I would call it, you know, some people refer to things as core books.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose you could consider the Game Master's Guide a core book, but it's in the sense that it's extremely useful. And it's, we hope, a very valuable tool to game masters. But it's not necessarily vital in terms of play. And I probably shouldn't even be saying that.
It's like, you don't really have to go out and buy this, but really please do.
Yeah, please do. In the sense that everything you need to play the game, the complete rule set is in the Hero's Handbook.
Right.
You know, the material in the Game Master's Guide is largely an expansion of that, and is really intended to provide the game master with a lot of really very useful ready-made tools and ideas in order to, you know, help jumpstart the game and adventure design process. It isn't necessarily full of rules that you couldn't, if you didn't have the Game Master's Guide, you just couldn't run Mutants and Masterminds.
Right, right.
Obviously, since folks have been running it
for about a year now,
without it, you know, all the way up till now.
Yeah, actually for over a year now.
Yeah.
But one thing I did ask John, and I figured I'd pitch this past you as well. The first supplementary, like, hardcover that I remember from second edition was the Masterminds Manual.
Mm-hmm.
How would you say that the Game Master's Guide for third edition differs from the Masterminds Manual? What makes it different and in form and purpose, as if you will?
Well, the Masterminds Manual really grew out of while I was designing Mutants and Masterminds second edition, I had started initially I'd started putting in a few sidebars here and there of various rules options, and, you know, well, if you don't like this, you can do it this way, or, you know, hey, here's an interesting different way to do this thing that isn't the way the game does it, but is also kind of cool, and things like that. And those started to get kind of – they started to kind of clutter up the text and were distracting. And John Lighthouser, who was the editor at the time, was rightly pointing out that they were a distraction. So I shifted them to an appendix in the back of the book and continued to work on the book, and the appendix continued to grow and grow until the point where an appendectomy was clearly called for, because the appendix was threatening to swallow the rest of the rule book. And so we cut the appendix out entirely, and had what amounted to about half of the content that ended up in Mastermind's manual. And so we just said, hey, you know, we've got a whole ton of, you know, optional rules variants and discussion of, you know, how the game is put together and whatnot. Why don't we just build a book around this and we'll do it as a separate book? And that's where Mastermind's manual came from. And I think that in some regards, Mastermind's manual it really didn't quite fulfill expectations, because I think that people were expecting initially a book that was more like what Game Master's Guide is now, which is to say a book on how to run the game. Mm-hmm. With a lot of the tools for doing that. And really what Mastermind's manual primarily was a book on how to hack the game and how to, you know, take things and pull parts out and plug new parts in and, you know, change the rules around. Right. Which, you know, while certainly fun for some, you know, is not necessarily a guide on how the game is supposed to be run.
It also seemed to be that it was one of the first places where you really had a chance to kind of discuss and consider the way powers were built in Second Edition. It seemed to almost lead into the concept for the whole Ultimate Powers book.
It did. It did. It informed a lot of the design that went into that book. And so Game Master's Guide is definitely much more what it says on the cover in that regard. It's a tool or a collection of tools for the game master to help make running the game easier and to provide some useful, what I hope is useful, advice on you know, the different elements and aspects of running the game. So it's less... considerably less focused on the idea of hacking the game and necessarily messing around with a lot of the elements, although there is some of that in Game Master's Guide.
Yeah, it seems to be. Yeah, the it seems to have been relegated back to not quite an appendix, but a single chapter out
pretty
of the
close.
Book. But well, let's go. Since we're talking about content of the book, let's go ahead and take a look at it. If you want, we can go chapter by chapter here.
Sure.
Since you've established such a wonderful organizational scheme by writing the book, we might as well go through it in order. one thing I wanted to, you know, I really enjoyed was the section on settings. It's the first chapter in the book, and it's not the smallest chapter. It's actually pretty beefy.
Oh, it's pretty good sized, yeah.
Yeah. It seems to contain a lot of the information from the various age books that you published in Second Edition. It has special attention given to how the GM can set up his world, and you mentioned the different super aspects like the supernatural, magic, mysticism, the cosmology of your universe, how to put it together. How did you approach that chapter, and what new information did this book bring that may not have appeared in the age books?
Well, a lot of the, you know, like you said, a lot of the chapter concept work was largely done in the form of setting advice material we had done in Second Edition, as well as in the various age books for Second Edition. So this chapter was really primarily a matter of you know, consolidating and condensing a lot of that material to get at, you know, the real essentials about the different aspects of the genres and world building and how to create your own setting. So there was a great deal of sort of finessing and editing and the like to get those essential elements in there. And I, you know, I'm trying to think of exactly new material in that chapter. A lot of it is more a matter in terms of organization and updating. Mm-hmm. I'm sure there are some new sections and sidebars here and there in various places. But a lot of it was really consolidating a lot of the really good material we had about that particular subject.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's really handy to have it in one place. I'll be glad when I have a print version that I can use at the table a little more easily. But it's especially when I'm sitting down to come up with a setting. It's nice to have something in front of me like that where I can go through and look at all the options that you've outlined for us. Why did you put the settings chapter first? I mean, it seems like a logical progression when you're building a campaign, but
well, that was pretty much the idea. Was that settings provide context, and that pretty much everything else, unless you're going with assuming a very default sort of four color superhero comic book setting. Settings are really what provide the context from which everything else in the game flows. So the decisions you make in terms of setting up the world are going to greatly impact then whom the players are playing, for that matter, who the heroes are, and who their adversaries are, and what their goals are, and how all of that plays out. Because, deciding you're going to set up a sort of weird science World War II campaign versus building a sort of near future, cyberpunkish superhero setting are going to have a substantial effect on the type of characters and stories you're going to be telling. So that was really the primary idea, was those were the choices you want to make first.
Okay. And then the second chapter focuses on villains and other antagonists. For me, I like the fact that you really focused in on the motives and tactics that villains use. That those sections of the book that chapter were really fun for me. It seems like that part to me just kind of jumped out at me as something that you had said that a lot of the material for this book also came from the canceled Supervillains Handbook project. Is this really like some of that first material, where that came from?
Yeah, a lot of the initial material in chapters 2 and 3 developed from stuff in two and four. 3 was not necessarily so much, but 2 and 4 was a lot of stuff from Supervillains Handbook that we adapted for our purposes here.
Okay, what's your favorite part of the adversaries section? I mean, what's your favorite part of writing bad guys?
I like the fact that the adversaries section focuses on talking about how to create villains in terms of their motives and their goals first, before we talk about how to build them in terms of plugging in the numbers and deciding what their strength or their attack values are. So I liked the idea of addressing the idea of, what is it about this villain that makes him or her an interesting character or an interesting personality? And then making the game element not necessarily secondary, but something that comes after you've thought about that and decided what this character is like. So I definitely liked that aspect of the way it was arranged. And I liked the... I'm pretty happy with how the villain tactics section came out in terms of talking about how to run villains in the context of the game, because I hope that will be information that's helpful for game masters who might find that prospect a little overwhelming in some regards. Plus, I'm particularly fond of being able to use the header minions as cover.
Yeah, I was just looking at that. I was going to say something about that. But yeah.
So
I was actually just flipping through the pages and going, yeah, that's what I wanted to mention. And there you go. You got me. You beat me to the punch.
I'm very proud of that. What's the point of minions if they don't give you a cover bonus?
Yes, exactly. Well, I do have to say that flipping through while we're talking about it reminded me and I said this when I was talking to John, but man, the art in this book is fantastic.
Yeah, isn't it though?
Yeah, I love the section with Princess fighting the cybernetic dinosaurs.
Yes.
That's just fantastic stuff. Just the different styles of the artists, but they're all very comic book looking, you know, very modern and very detailed. And then the one section where we're talking about the motives of the villains, that's, I'm trying to remember the electrical Frankenstein style
character. Dr. Shock.
Dr. Shock, of course. Yeah. And the Rubber Bandit and
Cerberus Rex.
Cerberus Rex, that's his name. So many characters in this setting. But, you know, I actually love the color schemes and everything. So they did a fantastic job.
Yeah.
But yeah, that section was really, you know, I always try to think in terms of, you know, it's kind of strange when I'm writing because I'm an artist as well. So I tend to think, I have a very visual shorthand.
Right.
So I'm sketching when I'm writing my characters. So I don't necessarily think in terms of motives as written words or, you know, sitting down and planning out their motives. I just kind of sketch their personality and see it. So it's kind of interesting to see something like this where we're looking at it from, you know, a little more of a, I guess, a critical approach that can help you then inform the next step, which, of course, is Chapter 3, the archetypes, where you start looking at the actual power sets and...
All the nuts and bolts. And... That was a pretty substantial chunk of the book in terms of the amount of work that went into it, because there obviously there's a lot more game mechanics in that chapter, and
that's like
a lot
60
of,
pages long, that one chapter.
Yeah.
It's huge.
Yeah,
that's much bigger than the archetype section in the second edition book were.
And one of the things that I really wanted to do was to really expand out the different archetypes and really talk about a lot of the different variations of theme that you can do with them, as well as a lot of – I really like the different classic bits sections for the archetypes, to talk about the sort of things that you can kind of expect from that type of character, as a supervillain, in that kind of, you know, context, because I think those things really make the individual game stats for the archetypes more usable, and gives you a lot of opportunity to, you know, sort of reskin them in different ways that create lots of different villains, even though the numbers are very, very similar.
And for people who don't play video games enough, that's reskin them sounds pretty awful, but I think
yeah, it does actually.
But it's generally what we say when we're talking about putting a new face on a framework or something. Basically, like when you're sculpting something, or you basically take an idea and apply it to an existing structure. But I love the expanded archetypes in here, the new ones that you've got in here, and of course the artwork. But I really love the level of depth. The fact that, you know, you look at Assassin, and in like the second edition book, it was two pages facing each other, and this one, you've got at least three pages on each archetype, and. Significantly more material and tactics, information, all sorts of good stuff. So that's what I really liked, is that you really went through and helped flesh out how to use these archetypes and what they can accomplish in terms of the rules here.
Well, and hopefully that, you know, in addition to providing a set of useful characters largely as is, hopefully the archetypes provide a lot of useful examples for game masters who are looking to design their own villain characters to start as starting points.
There's also a good section, expanded section on... I want to say I keep wanting to say a monster manual, but it includes a lot of
all the minion archetypes.
The minion archetypes. You've got everything from creatures, and of course, I mentioned this to John, but I still love that giant spider picture. That artwork
I know.
Is
isn't
great.
That great? Those are all the, you know, the stock characters that you know you're going to encounter in all kinds of superhero games in one form or another, and mm-hmm. you know what Mutants and Masterminds Game Master doesn't at some point need, you know, hey, I need a giant robot or a, you know, monstrous spider or what have you. You know, it's just handy to be able to flip open the book and say, you know, there we go.
Yep. So going on from archetypes, you then go to plots. Now, the plots are obviously, you know, what the you have you actually just discussed this at the beginning of the chapter. You have two ideas when you mention a plot. You could either be talking about the storyline, or you could mm-hmm. be talking about the villain's evil plan.
Right.
So right. This chapter for you is more about the actual villain's plans, right?
Generally.
Okay.
Though we do talk some about the other type of plot mm-hmm. as well, which is how the heroes fit into the villain's evil plan. But yeah, just because the superhero genre as a whole tends to be a somewhat reactive one, it's usually the thing that puts the story in motion is the villain does something, and then the heroes are looking to stop the villain from doing or trying to do whatever it is he or she is doing. That's generally the sort of standard superhero plot. You know, mm-hmm. the villain steals something, the villain threatens something, what have you. The villain does something, and then the heroes react to it. So that chapter really looks at, you know, what all of those somethings could be. And you know, in addition to providing game masters with just a substantial, you know, springboard in terms of coming up with ideas, it also looks at some of the permutations of those ideas and some of the things to think about when you're putting together, you know, one of those plots that may not necessarily be immediately apparent and may need to be thought through before you know. Put the, you know, villain's evil scheme into motion, you know, such as the, you know, talking about, you know, villains whose, you know, raison d'etre is some sort of, you know, threatening world destruction, you know, of some kind or another, you know, the sidebar discussing, well, you know, what happens if the villain wins? Mm-hmm. You know, if you are going to threaten to blow up the world, you know, there's, you know, especially in an RPG context, there's always a possibility that the heroes won't succeed in saving it.
Right. So
then what do you do?
Exactly. Does this end the game? Do you have to come up with some sort of way for the heroes to put it back together?
Right. So there's a lot of that, you know, sort of thing. And just sort of taking things through to their logical conclusion and looking at a lot of the different ways you can spin them. Mm-hmm. And also just, you know, hopefully ways you can take a lot of the somewhat tired plot ideas and breathe some life into them and keep them interesting.
And of course, one of my favorite bits, just because ever since John put out the random character generator, I've started to remember why I liked charts back in the mm-hmm. 80s.
Yep.
There's the 100 adventure ideas.
Yeah, if you're really stuck,
yep.
you know, can get, you know, just pick a, you know, roll up a random adventure idea, pick a random adventure idea, and run with it.
Yep. So that's actually one of my favorite chapters, just because you did, you know, kind of go through and talk about not just, you know, what kinds of plots they might have, but why that they tackle each kind of thing. You know, what, you know, why would someone want to destroy the world? You know, what, mm-hmm. what would be the purpose and the motivation for the villain? You know, some villains are just out to completely annihilate, you know, for revenge, but some of them are, you know, have deeper motives for doing it. And I love the mm-hmm. fact that you cover a bunch of that in there. So that to me, I think, was what really kind of jumped out at me is my favorite aspect to that you were able to cover all of those nuances in there.
Mm-hmm.
But, and of course, when you're facing a villain's plot, then you have to face there's challenges that go with it. And
right.
That is actually my number one favorite chapter in the whole book. I love the challenges system that you guys mm-hmm. dropped into third edition. I mean, it's something that I think it was kind of, I don't know if you actually ever set up a system for illustrating it in second edition, but its challenges are something that I've seen pop up in different games as a structure for doing things since the 80s. But I really, really like the way you guys have done it in Mutants and Masterminds. It's very easy to do, but it also allows for a lot of different permutations. So let's talk about that. What kind of challenges have we illustrated here in this chapter?
Well, I mean, a lot of the stuff in the challenges chapter are basically things that the heroes have to overcome that aren't adversaries as such, you know, that are, you know, adversity, certainly, but not, you know, personified. They're not villains. They're not minions. They're not usually things that the heroes can just hit, amongst other things. You know, and the two big examples of challenges in the book are the various kinds of natural disasters and environmental hazards that heroes run into all the time, you know, ranging from, you know, avalanches to, you know, earthquakes and volcanoes and, you know, forest fires and whatnot. And the ever popular death trap, which is probably the most common superhero challenge that characters face.
And one of the hardest things for a GM to work into his game without irking the players.
Yeah, it can be kind of difficult because of the fact that death traps and such aren't really opponents as such. There's a very impersonal quality to them. And, you know, while you can, you know, kind of focus your ire on a villain for being troublesome, you know, when you're stuck with a death trap, you know, there's almost nobody to blame but the GM. So players have a tendency to sort of focus their ire on the game master for sticking them with a death trap. And
it's like, don't blame me, blame Dr. Doom.
Exactly. It's the villain's fault. So, you know, the idea of the challenges, what system was to provide, you know, some game context that makes overcoming things like death traps and disasters and other hurdles that may be in the hero's way something gameable that adds a quality to it where the heroes can you know have a little give and take to it that's somewhat like but not exactly like combating a villain. So there's the give and take of the degrees of success and failure that the characters develop over time as they're working to overcome the challenge.
One of the things I really liked was the suggestion towards allowing the heroes to kind of improvise as much as possible to bring their personal skills to bear on a situation where they might not immediately see a connection.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And a lot of this is a matter of game philosophy. Some might see that as kind of weaselly and you know bordering on cheating to encourage, you know, well, for players to be, you know, like, you know, can my, you know, character's knowledge of you know obscure medieval literature, you know, help him out in this situation, you know, that in some instances that would just be seen as, you know, just like, you know, kind of a weaselly way to get yourself an advantage when you don't really have one. You know, in the, it so fits into the source material of the genre, that it's, I mean, it's something that heroes do all the time. And, you know, it really, rewards players for both thinking creatively and, you know, using what their characters have available to them as resources in the context of the game rather than, you know, there's nothing worse than being put into the situation of, well, there's only one solution to this problem and you don't have it and you can't figure out what it is.
Right.
So you're basically
or your character isn't built around that solution.
Right. So. Or your character isn't built optimized for that solution. You know, like the only solution to this death trap is this amazingly good acrobatics roll, and your character has a -1 dex and no acrobatics. And,
yeah.
You know, so it's like, oh, You know, that's just mean. That's what that is, you know.
I mean,
or at the very least, if you're going to set that situation up, then when the player comes up with a fair alternative, you know, to it, you know, give them a shot at it, at the very least. So yeah, I'm very much a believer that you should be encouraging players to think, you know, creatively when it comes to dealing with challenges.
Yeah, there's one of the things that I try to do when I'm presenting my players with a challenge is to really kind of let them write half of it. Well, mm-hmm. when they, you know, I basically present them with the idea, and I have right. my difficulty numbers sketched out based on how much, you know, basically how difficult and how long I plan to run that particular scene. You know, I kind of mm-hmm. base it on that, and then right. I kind of let them tell me how they're going to approach it. And
right, right, and that lets them fill in the traits that are going to be relevant mm-hmm. to the challenge, because once you know basically the difficulty and the degree of the challenge, you can plug in any traits you want. Mm-hmm. As long as the players have some sense of, or can come up with some justification of how that applies.
Which really goes back to the descriptor-based nature of Mutants and Masterminds to begin with.
Yes, absolutely.
So what's your favorite death trap?
I like a lot of the various death traps, but I have to say my favorite kind of death trap is sort of a variation on the, you know, sort of ticking time bomb death trap that is the one that turns out to have ultimately been a bluff, or, you know, the death trap that turns out not to have really been a death trap in the end.
The old bait and switch.
Yeah, the old sort of bait and switch approach, because I think that, you know, in some ways that's one of the most fiendish death traps of all. There's a great, a number of folks are not huge fans of DC's character Prometheus, but in his first appearance in Justice League, there's one of, you know, where Prometheus has devised all of these countermeasures dealing with all the different members of the Justice League, so he can take them all down. One of them is that he has these mines, these explosives that are laced throughout the Watchtower that are triggered to go off by Flash's super speed. That if, you know, Flash moves above normal human speed, you know, it'll just set these explosives off. And, you know, the very last thing is Prometheus gets beaten, and the very last thing he says is, you know, Flash, oh, by the way, about the bombs, I was bluffing. You know, he's like, all you had to do was believe that you couldn't move at super speed, and, you know, it's just as good.
Yep.
You know, so
that's a good one.
That to me is a really clever death trap.
And a good opportunity for a player to choose to roll his insight check.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. You know, is the bad guy bluffing?
Yep.
You know.
So yeah, I have to say that I've been one of my favorite places to look for death traps, and this kind of goes back to my Silver Age love, is the old Adam West TV show Batman.
Oh yeah, yeah, absolutely. Batman was the master of getting into and out of death traps.
Yep.
You know, every Batman villain had to have their own, you know, particular shtick when it came to fiendish death traps.
Yep. Giant typewriters, you yep. know, everything.
Giant coin flippers.
Yeah, almost as good as the giant boomerang that the...
Yes,
The infamous classic giant boomerang that they tied the Flash to. Yes. No matter, I have no idea how they got the Flash onto the boomerang to begin with, yep. but...
Yep. Well, that, you know, that was, you know, they had the, you know, the homage in Justice League Unlimited, where in fact the giant boomerang death trap features in the episode that gives Orion the, you know, the straight line Flash. You appear to be tied to a giant boomerang.
Yes. You know, that was a great episode. Man. Yeah, I love the fact that Batman in that episode is not the grouchy one. It's Orion.
Oh, it's Orion. Yeah. Batman is like, wow, chill. Like, you need to lighten up. It's pretty bad when Batman thinks you're a little too serious.
Exactly. All right, so that leads us to the last full chapter of the book, which is chapter 6, Options. And this is what we were talking about earlier, where this is more of the sort of rules, options, and different variations that you can use and expand on. You've got a wealth system for people who want to use purchasing style rules, set of guidelines for reputation. I'm trying to remember if you really covered reputation in the Mastermind's manual. Was that something you did?
We did.
Okay. Yeah. And then, of course, you've got the mass combat rules, which are always a favorite for me because I can't tell you how often I use those.
Yeah, they're very handy.
I also tend to run a lot of different genres under Mutants and Masterminds. So, I mean, I'll do fantasy combat where, you know, a few heroes have to stand up against an army of orcs or whatever you want to call them. So those are perfect for that.
Yep.
Of course, your section on fighting styles, martial arts.
Yep.
I know that at least one rule in here, John and I were talking about it last time. You've been doing a series of Avengers gaming blogs, you know, where you basically deconstruct episodes of the Avengers cartoon, the Earth's Mightiest Heroes cartoon.
Yep.
And I have to be candid and say I haven't been reading the last few because I haven't been watching the episodes yet.
Oh, well, yeah, because they've got spoilers in them. So.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But how much of this section is actually new material like that, where you have the where you've had, you know, because I know you had a chance to drop then in there just recently, but John said that was kind of the exception, not the rule.
Yeah, I would say that's pretty accurate. There were definitely a few bits and pieces in the book that were either informed by thought processes that I had worked out in the blog, or vice versa, stuff that I had worked on in the book informed some of the things I'd thought about while I was watching the episodes and saying, oh, yeah, that's kind of like that thing. So, you know, some of the stuff in the, you know, the stuff in the options chapter about allowing players a little bit more latitude in terms of improvising stunts with their extra effort and hero points was definitely something that kind of came up in the process of writing the blog. And some of the stuff in the villain tactics chapter on adversaries was definitely inspired by watching a lot of our superhero animation as opposed to reading comic books, because there's a very different flow to combat in animation than there is in static comic book panels. That although there are some certain similarities that carry over, you can definitely see a different sort of tempo to the way combats play out. And so that definitely informed some ideas as far as things that the game masters are would want to keep in mind as far as villains fighting heroes, especially one or a small number of villains fighting a larger number of opponents.
Right. I did read that discussion you were talking about, you know, giving like a villain extra actions to deal with a larger number of heroes and things like that.
So there was definitely some of that, but the majority of the stuff in Chapter 6 is options that, to one degree or another, existed in second edition that we knew were fairly popular that we wanted to provide in one form or another for game masters who liked them and wanted to use them.
Yeah, and of course the ever popular knockback rule.
Yes,
people were clamoring for.
Yes, lots of people wanted knockback. So I mean, the system is definitely in there for folks who want a crunchier, you know, mechanical system that determines what, you know, when knockback happens and what distance and what damage and all of that other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So,
let's see. What was the One question I did have for you is basically, well, actually, we answered that one already. We were talking about powers or options for powers, but you're really going to try and cover those in the power profiles, I think, it sounds like.
Yes.
So it's not like you're going to be discussing the powers in detail in this particular chapter.
No. Okay. No. You're not going to find a lot of power variants or options in the Game Master's Guide.
Okay. And then speaking of appendices,
yes,
the villain lairs. I love the maps in this section. This is
yes, just, aren't they great?
Yeah, the artwork's great. The maps are great, and of course these touch on, you know, all my favorite Silver Age type things. The island lair, I think, is my favorite.
Yeah, mine too. I have a soft spot for the island lair, especially if you add a volcano.
Yes.
Make it an island volcano lair, then it's perfect.
And I just want a good barrier reef to scuba dive off of.
Yep. Sure.
But so that would be your pick if you were a super villain,
definitely.
You'd want the island lair?
Definitely. I mean, you know, volcano lairs, you know, get, you know, geothermal power, you know, they're green, alternative energy.
There you go.
You know, I mean, you know, if you're going to be, you know, planning on ruling the world, you want to make sure that, you know, you limit your, you know, carbon emissions and all that.
Yeah. I'm not sure if you're limiting your carbon emissions by sitting on top of a smoking caldera, but...
You know, well, you know.
But,
better than, you know, having, you know, coal-fired, you know, pits of Mordor, you know, sort of thing.
That's true. I love the, you know, I love the fact that it took me about three times looking at the map before I saw the skull in the island shape.
Uh-huh. Yeah, of course.
That was great.
Giant skull in your island, I mean.
That was fantastic. So is what basically putting this book together, what was your favorite part about it? What was the worst part about it?
Well, the favorite part was just getting to think about all of the cool supervillain stuff, because obviously the Game Master's book is fairly heavily focused on supervillains as the adversaries and driving force in a superhero game. So there was a lot of opportunities to just think about supervillains and, you know, what made them tick and what made them cool and, you know, why they got all the cool stuff and, you know, all of that stuff. So that was lots of fun. You know, I'm trying to think of the difficult parts of the book. I think that really the primary difficult part was just making sure that it would all fit. there was a lot of ground to cover.
Yeah.
We ended up the book ended up being already a little larger than we had originally planned. We wanted to fit all the stuff we had into it. So it was tricky trying to make sure that we covered as much as we could with, you know, a certain amount of brevity. Mm-hmm. In a lot of areas that things were useful but just didn't go on and on, and, you know, hopefully, you know, were tightly, you know, put together enough that people could get the, you know, the essentials out of it without it, you know, expounding at great length.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have a couple of questions from the forums I wanted to shoot past you, but before I do, I just wanted to mention, I mentioned this to John, I'll mention this to you, and I'll tug on Chris Pramus's ear if I can ever get him on the show. If you guys ever decide to, I will be right first in line to buy it. If you would like combine the Hero's Handbook and the Game Master's Guide into a hardcover, a single hardcover book, I would so buy that.
We've talked about it. You know, and it would be a pretty mammoth book. You know, I mean,
have you seen the Pathfinder hardcover?
I have. I mean, and if we were to do a book like that, it would have to be a hardcover, just to accommodate the size of it.
Yep.
But yeah, I mean, it's an idea we've knocked around.
That's cool. I hope you guys think about it and hope it works out for you. But let me go on to some Atomic Think Tank questions. Foreshadow. Who one of our more verbose posters on the think tanks asked, basically it sounds like he wants to know how your work on previous role-playing games, especially superhero role-playing games, kind of informed your work on Mutants and Masterminds 3rd Edition and the Game Master's Guide in particular.
Well, it's difficult to point to, you know, one thing and say, oh yeah, this clearly came from this other thing. you know, I like to think that having worked on a number of different superhero RPGs in one form or another, having done design on different previous editions of Mutants and Masterminds, and having done development and a lot of interaction with the players and fans of the game over the years, has provided me with a pretty good perspective on how to advise game masters. That I have, you know, I hesitate to call it wisdom, but that I have some experience to impart in that regard. And so that certainly informed a lot of, you know, what I wrote in the book. A lot of that comes from, you know, having seen it in different iterations and different forms of gameplay and game design, that these are common things that come up, that these are things to be aware of, that these are different ways or approaches of doing things. I think if I were going to point at a particular influence that shows up in Game Master's Guide, I will say that having worked a little, having done design on Icons, which was a much lighter superhero game design than Mutants and Masterminds that I did, that Icons definitely had some influence in terms of bringing back some of the joy of the random table to Game Master's Guide. So like the 100 plots idea, there are, you know, a number of, for example, a number of the villain archetypes have random tables. I'm particularly fond of the psycho obsession table that gives you your 20 options for what crazy motif the psycho archetype is based all of his shtick around. You know, and I just find that a lot of those sorts of resources are just really handy sort of springboards for game masters to who are looking for an idea. And, you know, you could just get one, and even if the initial one you come up with isn't the one, you know, oftentimes it's just getting the one you don't want and going, you know, I really don't like that, but this other option, that's kind of cool. You know, and sometimes it's just that's all you need to get unstuck and kind of grease the wheels, you know, creatively, and you know, get yourself moving and say, oh, okay, you know, I can run with this, you know, and kind of take it from there. So I definitely did introduce a little bit more of that into Game Master's Guide as a resource, and you know, John, you know, really took that idea and ran with it and just knocked it out of the park in the Quick Start character generator for the Game Master's Kit.
Yeah, the Quick Start generator. I also had the privilege of playtesting that, so I got to see some of the early iterations. That was one of those concepts that years and years of playing point by supers games had kind of prejudiced me against. And it wasn't until I sat down and started rolling up some characters with my brother,
you discovered it was hours of fun.
Exactly. The first thing that came out was a scientist wolf, or intelligent wolf who was a scientist and a spiritual leader for his people. We're just looking at this going, wow, how could we actually describe that?
Yeah, where Jack do we Kirby get an could origin have created story? That guy.
Exactly.
In fact, I think he may have at some point. But
yeah, I mean, that was the fun of the randomness, and it was and those tables, even when you don't use them randomly, have become a huge advantage to helping my players who aren't necessarily experts at Mutants and Masterminds sit down and build a character based on just picking their way through those, which just makes it so much easier for them to kind of, you know, empowers them to build a character as opposed to just having to pick an archetype.
Yeah, exactly. And you'll see more of that in Power Profiles.
Awesome.
So it's a lot of that sort of menu option is gonna continue through that. So there's going to be more of, hey, I want this.
Very cool. On the same lines, actually, a poster from the forums, Jason 1414 is basically asking, have you guys ever thought about a Mutants and Masterminds basic version written for younger audiences, a way he could introduce the game to new players? His son loves Icons and says, mm-hmm. great work, Steven Adamant crew, by the way. But it would be nice to have a box set, sort of like Dragon Age or Pathfinder, the mm-hmm. beginner box, that includes dice, simplified rules, tokens, and stuff like that.
We've talked about some different approaches to doing some sort of fairly introductory Mutants and Masterminds product. We did the M&M Beginner's Guide mm-hmm. for second edition, which went over fairly well. We've talked about approaches either similar to that or Jason suggests, something that's more of a sort of, you know, basic set kind of approach. And we're still, you know, kind of mulling over what the options and prospects are in that regard. Mm-hmm. The difficulty with starter sets that have a lot of components to them is that they have a tendency to run counter to their purpose because they also tend to be expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't want to make the simple, easy buy-in to the game more expensive than getting the big core rulebook.
That would be a little ironic.
That seems a little counterintuitive, and we certainly don't want. I mean, we want people to feel they're getting their money's worth, and not that they're, you know, hey, I, you know, bought this, you know, really stripped down simple version of the game, and, you know, paid a fair amount of money for it, and it doesn't do half as much as that big cool version over there does. That's been a consideration as well. It's trying to find a happy medium in mm-hmm. terms of what will provide the best value, as well as providing a good introduction. It may be something similar to the second edition beginner's guide, which could probably be adapted for third edition in a number of ways.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd certainly be interested to see something like that. I've seen a lot of really cool not published yet, but I can't remember his name, but there was an artist who posted some of his character sheets for D&D that he built for his kids, and very, very cartoony, very yep. very simplified, but they introduce mm-hmm. all the important elements of how to play the game,
yeah.
and yet they introduce the characters in a very cool kind of Brave and the Bold art style, mm-hmm. and I thought I don't know if you've seen those wandering around the internet, but
I think that I have, actually.
I can't remember his name, and it's driving me crazy, but
there
are some really cool stuff out there for, you know, trying to introduce these ideas to the next generation mm-hmm. of players, and I'd like to see, you know, more people picking up Mutants and Masterminds. I certainly enjoy playing the game myself.
I certainly wouldn't argue with that.
So, I'm just trying to think. Are there any other projects you're working on outside of what we talked about already that you wanted to mention? Like, you've mentioned Icons. Do you have any Icons projects coming up?
I just finished an Icons project. Gareth has Gareth Starka from Adamant mm-hmm. Entertainment, which publishes Icons, has a book coming out called Icons Team Up. Mm-hmm. That is basically, in some regards, is kind of the Icons Game Master's Guide, in the sense that it deals a lot with a lot of options, examples of play, expanded essays on how to handle some things in the game, a lot of various rules options, some expansions of some of the basic systems to provide some more stuff for headquarters and equipment and those sorts of things. So I wrote a fair portion of that. That I believe is, last I heard, scheduled to come out in November. So,
oh, very cool. Cool.
Folks should be seeing that relatively soon.
Excellent. Yeah, I believe I remember Dan was talking about the artwork for that. So hopefully
yeah.
get to see some more Dan Houser artwork soon.
Yeah, Dan was particularly excited about that book because he gets to draw, you know, character team ups of characters working together. Mm-hmm. So he was coming up with all these different combinations of heroes and villains working together for different scenarios.
Very cool. Let's see. Aside from that, I guess the one thing I did want to remember to tell you is I wanted to thank you again. Dan and I were just happening by the Green Ronin booth, and you invited us into one of your demo games to kind of fill out the session there because you only had a couple of people. But I really appreciate you inviting us, and we had a lot of fun getting the game with you there.
Appreciate you guys being good sports and standing in so that the folks who really wanted to play could play. So
the irony of it was, I believe at least one of the players who was there, I believe his name was Nathan. I think he goes by, I'm trying to remember, I can't remember his forum name right now, but we had actually made plans to try and game. He wanted me to run a demo game for him sometime during the weekend, but I had to beg off because we were just too busy. So it was a really happy coincidence that we got to game together after all.
Oh,
so.
Cool! Well, I'm glad that worked out.
So again, thank you very much, and I really appreciate you taking your time out to sit down with me and talk about the Game Master's Guide. And really looking forward to seeing what you guys are going to do with the power profiles. That sounds like a really exciting product
cool.
for next year. And I guess until next time, we'll just ask you to stay vigilant.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much, and we'll see you again soon, Steve.
Take care, James.
Thank you.